Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, bringing you news from the Saturday, December 20th edition of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff. This is your volunteer reader, Joe Ganey. Welcome to the show, and we'll kick it off, as always, with our front page headline articles. First up there, we have a story by digital editor Cody Bashor. Agencies work to curb burn smoke impacts. While living in Flagstaff means being surrounded by pine and aspen, accompanied with views of the peaks and the traditional four seasons, it also includes experiencing the occasional impact of smoke. For those who manage the smoke, a byproduct of conducting the prescribed burns utilized to protect against the threat of wildfire, they are well aware of the general public's feeling toward the plumes of white and gray that hover above the region during specific times of the year. "Nobody likes smoke," said Noah Baker, a wildfire, climate, and community health specialist for the Flagstaff Fire Department. "We shaped our culture around an environment that had smoke sometimes, but that smoke was a really bad thing. Now we're kind of reshaping our culture in northern Arizona to say, we know you don't like smoke, we understand that, but seeing it, it's kind of something to celebrate sometimes because that means we're doing the right thing." Baker said the reality is that fire was suppressed from 1876 to 2004, leading to the need for prescribed burns to mimic the natural cycles of fire to create healthier ecosystems. He said it's his job to convince people that they are beneficial. "We have to live with it. But more than just live with it, we have to understand why," Baker said. "We have to kind of convince people of what I see all the time. I've been a firefighter since I was 18 years old, and I've had dozens of instances where I am losing a battle at a wildfire, and then suddenly that wildfire moves into a spot where they did prescribed fire. My job gets a lot easier, and I get to actually fight the fire. I wish I could convey that information to everybody, but I can't." Late fall burns. While most of the prescribed burn projects around Flagstaff have gone dormant for the winter, the regular run of announcements and advisors from multiple land management agencies alerting residents to potential smoke impacts will soon return. And when the spring burning season arrives, many of those projects might be seeking to make up for some lost time following a much wetter than average fall after a relatively dry monsoon season. The Flagstaff Pulliam Airport registered 10.35 inches of precipitation from September 1st to November 30th, the most in that three-month period since 12.76 inches fell in 1985, and the first time since 2019 that more than 4 inches was recorded. Though Arizona's monsoon season overlaps with the fall for the entirety of September, the 5.08 inches registered from June 15th to September 30th was the 17th lowest total since 1900. With the average temperature in September ranging around the mid-50s to low 60s in the past two decades, the drop down to the mid-40s to low 50s in October and mid-30s to mid-40s in November presents some issues in extending burns too late in the calendar year. It is congested. If you look at northern Arizona, the Kaibab, the Coconino, and everyone is trying to get it done, said Rick Miller, the fire management officer for the Northern District of the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management, or DFFM. This year was a prime example. None of us like burning in November, but we didn't have the conditions to burn. Then it compressed all of that toward the back end, toward November, when we don't historically burn that much. Those short days and colder nights, the smoke tends to sink real bad on you at nighttime. Burns from multiple agencies led to a smoky first few weeks of November as air quality numbers around the city spiked toward the 100s, well above the typical air quality numbers in the mid-teens and low 20s around the Flagstaff area. Between November 3rd and November 7th, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, or ADEQ, listed 9 ignition points ranging from north of Kendrick Peak down to Kachina Village, and from Rogers Lake out east to Doney Park. 4 more ignitions were located just north of Walnut Canyon in the Campbell Mesa area on November 11th and 12th. Multiple other ignitions in the region occurred around the same time, with 2 near Red Lake, 3 south of Tucson, and 4 around Happy Jack in the first 2 weeks of November. The burn projects, ranging from as small as 45 acres on Observatory Mesa to more than 1,400 acres just south of Arizona Snow Bowl, were conducted by the Flagstaff Fire Department, Arizona DFFM, and Coconino National Forest, and were announced in the days prior to the burns, following approval from ADEQ. Though the agencies make efforts to avoid smoke impacts to the city and its surrounding areas, all of them expressed it is the reality of the Northern Arizona region, where a century of fire suppression efforts has led to a buildup of forest fuels, posing the threat of a catastrophic wildfire. Air quality disruptions. According to Purple Air, a network of air quality sensors and real-time data utilized by the Environmental Protection Agency's AirNow Fire and Smoke Map, Google, and WatchDuty, among others, Flagstaff's air quality suffered greatly November 3rd to 8th in many areas around the city. A sensor in Flagstaff's Southside neighborhood registered a value of 131 during a 6-hour stretch in the afternoon of November 3rd. Beginning the stretch of poor quality on and off for the following few days. While Southside remained around 145 during the day on November 4th, it hit higher 6-hour readings around midnight on November 7th and November 8th, with values around 173 and 190, respectively. To the east, a sensor north of Linda Vista Drive had readings above 100 on multiple days between November 4th and November 8th, peaking around 157 for a 6-hour period around 6 a.m. November 7th. Even further east, a sensor in Doney Park east of Highway 89 and north of Townsend-Winona Road also peaked around 184 during its 6-hour period around midnight on November 7th, with values around 160 continuing at 6 p.m. November 7th and midnight on November 8th. Just west of Lake Mary Road and south of High Country Trail south of Flagstaff, the air quality was listed at 141 during a 6-hour stretch at night, November 4th into the morning of November 5th. Later that day, a sensor north of downtown Flagstaff on Hospital Hill increased to 158 during a 6-hour period, followed by midnight readings of 169 on November 6th, around 300 on November 7th, and around 325 on November 8th, all encompassing a similar 6-hour period. According to the Air Quality Index, abbreviated AQI, values between 0 and 50 pose little to no threat, while 51 to 100 is acceptable but may pose risks for some people who are sensitive to air pollution. Values between 101 and 150 are unhealthy for sensitive groups, while 151 to 200 is unhealthy to some members of the general population. Anything above 201 becomes a health risk for anyone in the area. Most of Flagstaff's sensors listed on Purple Air typically reside around the teens to low 20s, with most yearly averages landing in the high 20s to low 30s. The increased risk for diminished air quality as part of prescribed burns, or even wildfires burning for extended periods of time, such as the museum, tunnel, pipeline, and haywire fires, has led to efforts to reduce the negative impact. One thing we do now is an emergency distribution of air filters, and really, that has turned into kind of our bread and butter of that program because of how rewarding and helpful it is to show up to somebody's door with an air filter when they need it, Baker said. I wish we had more communities in Arizona that did that, because when we have a mitigation for that, we get a lot more support. Though the significant air quality impacts in 2025 appeared to be limited to the first few weeks of November, Baker said the city's fire department is aware that not everyone in Flagstaff knew going in that they would be living around prescribed fire. We understand folks who have lived in Flagstaff since 1980 or so may not have signed up to be part of that, Baker said, but if you're moving to Flagstaff, it's good to know that last year we did the most prescribed fire in the country, I believe. We treated the most acres with fire in the country, and we're proud of that, and a lot of people in our town are proud of that. Baker said the intent is to always burn under conditions with the least amount of smoke possible, while also generating as much wildfire risk reduction possible. And he admitted that sometimes those don't necessarily align, but we're always trying our best. There's going to be smoke somewhere. At the end of the day, when the sun goes down, the smoke is going to settle, Baker said. So how much of that smoke can I make sure does not impact the town? How much can I limit exposure to our residents? And how good of a job can I do mitigating that air quality decline? With the agencies looking to coordinate burns in the area reaching into the double digits based on the multiple jurisdictions across northern Arizona, ADEQ also has the ability to add conditions to the approval for burns or theoretically disapprove burns, though that is much more rare. Instead, coordination between the agencies through existing relationships between fire managers or calls with the ADEQ provide the chance to avoid significant smoke impacts before they occur. Coordination and planning. According to Michael Graves, the air quality meteorologist with ADEQ, the department is usually aware of what is coming through conversations with all of the agencies across northern Arizona. While smaller burns don't require more than a few days of notice, larger burns from the agencies with larger acreage will be arranged about a week in advance. They'll send us maps of the units because usually the project's broken up into multiple units, and they're going to give you a general plan based on what exists in the units they're going to plan to burn each of the days, Graves said. It can change, of course, depending on weather conditions, but we are aware of what's coming down the pipe. Graves added that ADEQ, by monitoring a portable particulate monitor in Flagstaff, can inform burn managers to ease back burns or pause should the impacts rise above the expected standard in order to ensure smoke is dispersing from the area. Notably, Flagstaff's monitor did record significant impacts to the air quality on November 7th and 8th, with the air quality returning to normal the morning of November 9th. Holding one of the largest pieces of the prescribed burn puzzle in the region, the Coconino National Forest, or CNF, knows there's a significant give and take when it comes to both conducting its own burns and planning projects around other agencies in order to avoid dropping too much smoke in one area. A map sits prominently in the office of True Brown, the fire chief for the CNF, representing the 10-year strategic plan for burn projects. We have really good relationships with our partners and cooperators, and we are able to make it work, Brown said. Do I wish it was simpler? Absolutely, but that's the reality of it. If the city of Flagstaff is burning inside the city, and we're looking at a burn that is somewhat lower priority, we will work to adjust and really look at things across the landscape. We've got lots of jurisdictional boundaries, but fire doesn't care about jurisdictional boundaries. To Brown's point, CNF and Arizona DFFM coordinated a joint burn in November in order to shorten the amount of time smoke is being dispersed into the air. As Miller explained, rather than each agency burning its acreage separately 2 days apiece, a large burn could be conducted across half the time. While the smoke may appear to be larger, it would exist for a much shorter time span that limits the exposure to the public. Without the communication between the different agencies, some of which oversee land laid out in checkerboard fashion across the state, joint burns likely wouldn't be within the realm of possibility. There's a good amount of information sharing between the state, the Coconino National Forest, the Kaibab National Forest, and the city of Flagstaff. We all know when each other is burning and get a good heads up, Miller said. We work with the Forest Service and we look at it as let's try to get the right opportunity and get big acres because we know that we're falling behind even with what we're burning. With fire previously occurring across the northern Arizona landscape year-round, Brown noted just how strategic a specific burn must be when taking into account the time of year, wind speed and direction, the remaining snowpack, and even the impact burns are going to have on the major roadways in and out of Flagstaff. Holding a menu of options available across its more than 1.8 million acres, the CNF sees itself as able to work around the priority projects for others in the area. After having conversations on when and where those other burns might take place in the coming year, Brown said that's when the CNF gets to work on finalizing its own plans. As we get closer to those climatic conditions and the fuel conditions being ready to go, we start honing in on exactly where and when we're going to burn, Brown said. It is tough because none of this is an exact science. We have a lot of good science that we're working with, but fire is a very dynamic tool that has a lot of opportunities for good, but also on the flip side, a lot of negative impacts that we're trying to deal with too. It is not an easy thing to do. It is an art and a science. Though Flagstaff naturally sees the impact of burns around the city, Brown said the predominantly southwest winds in the area end up significantly impacting the Navajo and Hopi, with the Verde Valley also hit as the cold air sinks down into the area south of where the burns are conducted, impacting their own homes. As Baker stated, no one likes smoke. That includes those operating on the ground at the burns and those who plan them while also living in the Flagstaff area. It's hard when my kids are stuck inside at school and they're getting questions like, "What's your dad doing?" It's frustrating, and I get that, Brown said. It is a short-term impact, but it's a short-term impact for a long-term protection and benefit. I hate boiling it down to that, but a lot of times that's what it is, because the more we can do on our terms, the less we all have to worry about when it comes to wildfires. Though the danger is slightly increased during the spring's burn windows, due to the warmer temperatures and unpredictability of the winds, those same impacts allow for greater smoke dispersion away from the area. The safer nature of fall burns is complicated by cooler temperatures that allow for smoke to linger for a longer period, though the cooler weather allows for people to keep their homes closed up tighter during fall burns, as opposed to when warmer temperatures necessitate open windows. We're looking at the indices and watching all these climatic conditions, Brown said. We're always bringing our A game to this, but when we're in the spring, the risk is just that much greater. so we have to pay just that much more attention. It's like you're playing in a championship game. For Baker, his agency's presence within the city limits of Flagstaff may occasionally be blamed for smoke it isn't responsible for, just because of its proximity to the smoke in the air. That's okay with us. We are here to help our federal partners. We'll send fire engines to prescribed fires to help out, Baker said. My job is to be outside in the community during smoke events, saying, I've got air filters here. We're okay getting the blame and sharing that load as well. Though Miller made clear he's not whining in my napkin or anything, he said those on the fire line are ultimately the ones dealing with the most significant smoke inhalation. Before heading home for the day and encountering the smell of smoke in their homes as well. Going out and burning, it's easy, I guess, the way I look at it, but it's always when you impact people's lives. It gets hard. We're very cognizant of that, 100%, Miller said. But until we invent smokeless fire, I think we're going to have that. And hopefully the message to everyone out there is, this is one of the components we need to keep a healthy forest. And that article was titled, Agencies Work to Curb Burn Smoke Impacts. Our next headline article today is written by Sunstaff reporter Abigail Kessler, and this is titled, Program Helped Students Transition to Middle School. Flagstaff Junior Academy pilots Crew for a year, and that's capital C, capital R, capital E, capital W. Flagstaff Junior Academy, abbreviated FJA, has introduced a new program this year to help students learn the skills needed to successfully transition to middle school. It is piloting an adaptation of the Crew curriculum from the national nonprofit EL Education, and all 70 of the sixth graders at its middle school will experience it. FJA has plans to expand the program to include 7th and 8th grade as well in future years, keeping the same cohorts as students progress through their time in middle school. The school's 6th graders take an hour-long crew class twice a week throughout the school year, with the same cohort or crew of around 15 students. Carrie Cola and Matt Sarnowski are the crew teachers, each leading sessions for half of the cohorts. The curriculum is designed to teach students life skills that connect to social, emotional learning and academic success. FJA is implementing it to help the students be successful in middle school and set a foundation for skills they can use as they continue through life, Sarnowski said. We wanted our sixth graders to feel welcomed, connected, and supported as they adjust to new routines, new teachers, and all the changes that come with adolescence in middle school, both socially, emotionally, and academically, FJA Executive Director Carissa Morrison wrote about the school's adoption of the Crew program. FJA's teachers have adapted the program to be hour-long lessons twice weekly as part of the school day, rather than 30 minutes three times a week. The curriculum is also designed with lessons specifically for a grade level. According to Sarnowski, his lessons often include some time outside at the end of the day, allowing students to bond and giving them some agency in their learning. He said the curriculum could cover issues that he's seen in his over 25 years teaching middle school. Real-world skills such as self-regulation, understanding, the importance of community, and what it means to be part of one. When they come to the Cedar campus, it's a whole different ballgame, Sarnowski said of the transition to middle school. They now have 6 different teachers rotating around, have hormones pumping through their bodies. They have all these new things happening. Topics covered in the lessons range from the physical structure of the brain and how it works for teenage development to how to self-regulate or how to give a proper apology. In early December, the classes had finished a unit on community service and were beginning to discuss strengths and how they work with the strengths of those around them. One activity Cola led was to sort themselves along a line based on how much they thought statements she read out loud applied to them. The class started with a warm-up activity similar to an icebreaker, during which students shared their mood based on a grid of expressive animal photos and discussed what superpower they'd like to have. We've been working on helping others. How strong can you get? And I want to say, like, the world, and how can we help? Said sixth grader Alice Torres about crew. She said she'd learned to help others and don't make yourself feel bad about yourself. Sixth graders Jay Hernandez-Jelks and Avery Phillips both mentioned the class discussions when describing crew. I think you can really share anything without being judged, Phillips said. You can share without anyone saying anything bad about you or talking about you, Hernandez-Jelks added. We've been learning life skills or stuff you can use later on in your life. Phillips said she had used the box breathing technique learned in crew to respond to anger, and Hernandez-Jelks said he'd taken steps to avoid distractions. He'd asked his parents to watch his puppy and keep his sister out of the room while he's doing his homework. Class is set up to have active student participation throughout, with the room rearranged into a circle of chairs. Sarnowski explained that the class also teaches students how to take part in these group discussions, which are different from how a typical elementary class is conducted, helping them feel comfortable about sharing their thoughts in this setting and teaching them to build on and support the ideas brought up by peers. They're learning how to engage in thoughtful conversation, showing that connection and learning how to further a conversation, he said. The lessons build on each other throughout the school year. Upcoming topics for the current class of sixth graders are academic responsibility and the school environment. Sarnowski said the students had especially enjoyed learning about brain development and neurodiversity. The unit had them map out the parts of the brain as well as list the approaches that work best for them. Do they like to multitask, for example, or do they enjoy organizing? And have a conversation with family members about what they'd learned. The community service lessons prompted students to analyze their goals and reasoning for their chosen acts of service, as well as similar work already being done and how to achieve their goals. Students filled out an analysis form to help them think through similar questions for small service projects, such as helping out with the dishes at home or picking up trash in a park. The crews had an ice cream party to celebrate the end of the unit while they reviewed what they had learned. Sarnowski said he's seen crew's impact through the way students behave in class. He said they're better able to focus, they bond with their classmates both in and out of class, and they discuss the connections between what they're learning and other parts of their lives. Sarnowski, who also runs the school's PBIS committee, said he hopes to see fewer sixth grade office referrals at the end of the year than they have in the past. Hopefully, they're all empowered to be more of school leaders by the time they're eighth graders. They're ready to continue to steer the culture of the school and take leadership opportunities, he said. Because if you don't give them the opportunity to be leaders, then they find other ways to lead the pack, which aren't always school appropriate. We're hoping this has a big school-wide effect. And that article was Flagstaff Junior Academy Pilots Crew Program to help students develop life skills as they transition into middle school. I'm going to pause momentarily here to remind you that you're listening to news from the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. SunSound's programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. You can listen to our live streams and learn how you can support SunSounds at the website sunsounds.org. And remember that we have a free app available for Apple and Android devices that allows you to get our stream and on-demand programs anytime you want. Okay, back to the news and to our final front page headline article. This is written by Sam McLaughlin. It's the latest episode in the Year in Review feature that the Daily Sun runs. This one dealing with crime in courts, entitled Sting, Judicial Turnover Lead to Turbulent 2025. The high-profile arrest of a Flagstaff media personality and the gory trial of a murder suspect drew the most attention in our local criminal justice system this year. But in the background, the Coconino County Superior Court was undergoing a year of transformation. Three new judges were selected in a six-month span. Here are some of the most notable stories from the Flagstaff and Coconino County criminal justice system in 2025. Zorn snared in police sting. After a three-decade career in broadcasting, Dave Zorn was a familiar voice on Flagstaff area radio covering news and youth sports. He also worked as a part-time instructor at Northern Arizona University. That all ended abruptly when Zorn, 53, was arrested in March on charges of luring a minor for sexual exploitation. Zorn was one of more than a dozen people charged in March and May as part of a multi-agency online sex sting coordinated by the Flagstaff Police Department. During the sting, law enforcement officers posed as minors using false profiles on adult personals websites and social media platforms. Zorn accepted a non-negotiated plea agreement in September and received a 1.5-year prison sentence to be followed by 10 years of probation and lifetime registration as a sex offender. At his sentencing hearing, he told the judge he was remorseful, embarrassed, and ashamed, and claimed to have renewed his religious faith since his arrest. Some of the other individuals arrested and charged in the sting operation have also accepted plea agreements, but a few of the cases remain pending as the end of the year approaches. One defendant has requested a jury trial. Jury convicts accused hotel murderer, but defense challenges verdict. In early November, a jury found Samuel Lionel Lee guilty of murder and sexual assault in the 2024 death of Sandy Singer. Singer had died of blood loss from severe trauma to her vagina and anus, inflicted while she and Lee were alone in a Flagstaff hotel room together. Following that verdict, however, Lee's defense attorneys filed a motion for a new trial. Because of a miscommunication between a courtroom bailiff and a detention officer, Lee had been improperly instructed not to look at the members of the jury. His attorneys argued that this violated his right to a fair and impartial trial. An evidentiary hearing is scheduled for December 30th to determine whether the jury's original verdict will stand. 2023 homicide case resolves with guilty pleas. In February 2023, Sharon Naki Yazi was reported missing. Her burned remains were discovered outside Sunset Crater National Monument. Two people were charged with abandonment or concealment of a dead body, but not with homicide. Lorene Brody Bell and Scott Richard Smith. Bell pleaded guilty to that original charge and served a short prison sentence. But after her release in 2024, she was rearrested on a new charge of murder based on the testimony of her former co-defendant. Smith told prosecutors that Bell was solely responsible for killing Naki Yazi and that he had helped hide the body afterward. She pleaded guilty in March to a single count of second-degree murder and was sentenced to 18 years in state prison. Smith's plea agreement resolved five separate felony cases against him. Besides the charges for his involvement in Nakayazi's death, he faced other charges of sexual exploitation of a minor, drug possession, unlawful possession of a firearm, and car theft. Smith pleaded guilty to one count of abandonment or concealment of a body and one count of sexual exploitation for possession of child pornography. He received a 10-year prison sentence. Police-involved collisions leave two dead. In two separate instances this year, Flagstaff Police Department officers were involved in fatal vehicle collisions while on duty. The first occurred June 3rd, when an officer driving a patrol vehicle struck the rider of an electric one-wheel skateboard near the intersection of Milton Road and Route 66. The rider, 22-year-old Derek Blakely, was transported to the Flagstaff Medical Center, but died of his injuries. The officer's identity has not been disclosed. FPD stated that the Arizona Department of Public Safety would conduct an investigation into the incident. The results of that investigation have also not yet been disclosed. The second fatal collision occurred September 20th, when former officer Jacob Buchwald was involved in a two-vehicle crash that killed the other driver, who was a graduate student at Northern Arizona University. Buchwald resigned from the force 3 days later, citing unspecified medical issues that allegedly contributed to the collision. The DPS is investigating that incident, too. Homicide suspect flees to Germany after dodging courtroom brawl. One of the more unusual hearings in Coconino County Superior Court this year occurred in October when a prosecutor and police detective informed a judge that the defendant in a homicide case had fled the country to avoid prosecution. Philip Green, 21, was facing a charge of manslaughter for the allegedly accidental fatal shooting of his friend Dylan Carter, 20. His case had already included one eventful hearing in June when Green rejected a potential plea agreement and the victim's father attempted to rush at him in the courtroom. Bailiffs and victim witness services staff stepped in to prevent a physical confrontation. Green affirmed in July that he wished to proceed to trial, but in early September, he reportedly used a German passport to leave the country. The Coconino County Attorney's Office was seeking the assistance of the U.S. Marshals Service to locate and extradite Green. Woman arrested after allegedly shooting mother. In mid-October, Flagstaff police officers responded to an early morning disturbance at a residence just east of the downtown area, heard a gunshot as they approached the home. Inside, officers found Maya Christine Brody, 46, and her mother, who was dying from a gunshot wound to the head. Brody was arrested and soon charged with first-degree murder. When Brody made her first appearance in Superior Court November 10th, she entered the courtroom grinning broadly and appeared relaxed and cheerful despite the seriousness of the allegations against her. Trial for man accused of mass shooter threats halted, new trial ordered. After a lengthy and at times contentious back and forth between the prosecution and the defense in the case of Justin Wayne Hill, who stands accused of making terroristic threats toward Flagstaff schools and businesses, a jury trial began December 2nd, only to come to a halt a week later. Hill wrote Yelp reviews and emails in September 2024, in which he said he had been labeled the next mass shooter. Coconino Community College was one of the recipients of those messages and closed its campuses until Hill was located and arrested in Montana. On December 9th, the judge overseeing Hill's trial declared a mistrial after a police officer giving testimony read aloud an email that was not on the approved evidence list. Hill's trial will start again from the beginning with a new jury in January. Superior Court closes COVID-era extra division. After 3 years of operating an additional criminal division to help reduce a backlog of cases from the COVID-19 pandemic, the Coconino County Superior Court closed down Division 7 at the end of June. The additional division had been made possible by short-term federal funding, and the county lacked the budget to sustain it indefinitely. Presiding Judge Ted Reed told the Arizona Daily Sun that the division had made a significant impact on the number of unresolved felony cases older than 1 year, and also helped provide flexibility and judicial coverage as the court navigated multiple retirements this spring. Though Division 7 has ended, the specialty courts, Veterans Court, Mental Health Court, and Recovery Court, will continue. Reed said he is continuing to look for a long-term or permanent funding. He is continuing to look for long-term or permanent funding to ensure the stability of those diversion programs. Retirements and replacements. There was significant turnover on the Superior Court's bench this year, including an unexpected and unusual departure. By August, three of the court's six adult divisions had new judges at the helm. Former Judge Kathleen Brown Nichols announced her retirement at the end of 2024. Governor Katie Hobbs appointed attorney Neil Sherman, previously a partner at the firm Antall & Sherman, to fill that vacancy in March. Following closely on the news of Sherman's appointment, former Judge Elaine Fridland Horn announced she would retire at the end of April. Hobbs chose Charles Dowdy, formerly of DNA People's Legal Services, to replace Fridland Horn. Then pro tempore Judge Brent Harris, who had served since 2022, departed the court at the end of June under unclear circumstances. He had been absent from the courthouse for at least 2 weeks, during which time the court administrator said Harris was, quote unquote, on leave. On July, Harris was, quote, no longer employed with the court, unquote. Presiding Judge Ted Reed appointed pro tempore Judge Roberta McVickers, previously serving in an on-call capacity, to take over the management of the court's Division 6 from Harris. County commits $20 million to jail improvements. In March, the Coconino County Board of Supervisors approved the issuance of $10 million in special obligation bonds to help fund the construction of a new and greatly expanded medical unit at the Coconino County Detention Facility. Another $10 million will come from the Jail District Fund. The planned medical unit will be approximately 15,000 square feet, with 24 beds, four safety cells, and its own recreational yard, effectively constituting an entire separate housing unit. The current medical unit, according to Detention Facility Commander Matt Figueroa, is a six-cell facility. In addition to creating more space for medical staff and patients, the expansion will allow the jail to more effectively separate the inmate booking, release, and transfer areas. Coconino County Sheriff Brett Axland provided an update on the project at an October meeting of the board. Construction is proceeding on schedule, Axland said, and should be complete in the first half of 2027. And that was Year in Review, Crime in Courts, Sting, Judicial Turnover, Lead to Turbulent 2025. And that wraps up our front page headline articles for today. Next up today, we have a series of news briefs from the Daily Sun staff. First one there, deputy city manager receives recognition from association. Shannon Anderson, senior deputy city manager for Flagstaff, will receive the credentialed manager designation from the International City/County Management Association, or ICMA, in January 2026, according to a press release from the city. ICMA's mission is to uphold the integrity of representative local government and promote the efficient, effective management of public services. To receive the credentialed manager designation, an ICMA member must have significant experience as a senior management executive in local government, have earned a degree, preferably in public administration or a related field, and demonstrated a commitment to high standards of integrity and to lifelong learning and professional development. I am honored to be recognized as a credential manager by ICMA, Anderson stated. It is a reflection of my commitment to the ICMA Code of Ethics and a high standard of integrity, which can help build trust in our local government. Our next brief is, some Grand Canyon trails to remain closed through June. Several popular trails in Grand Canyon National Park will remain closed to the public until at least June 30th, 2026, the National Park Service announced on Wednesday. The closures are necessary to accommodate ongoing construction on the Trans Canyon Waterline Replacement Project, as well as some trail rebuilding. The River Trail, which connects the bottom of Bright Angel Trail to the bottom of South Kaibab Trail, suffered a 50-foot collapse after heavy rockfall in August. The River Trail and Plateau Point Trail will be closed until July. The Silver Bridge, one of two suspension bridges over the Colorado River near Phantom Ranch, will also be closed. Access to Phantom Ranch will be via the Black Bridge only. To connect the Bright Angel and South Kaibab trails, hikers will need to use the Tonto Trail. The North Kaibab Trail is also closed north of the Clear Creek Trail Junction because of damage from the Dragon Bravo fire. The Park Service has not yet said when the North Kaibab Trail might reopen fully. Construction areas and closure dates are subject to change. Visit nps.gov/grca for the latest updates. Next brief here, CCSO announces addition of new canine team. The Coconino County Sheriff's Office, abbreviated CCSO, announced the addition of a new canine team on Wednesday as Deputy Ray Bauer and canine partner Ace successfully completed canine school and earned certifications in narcotics detection and patrol. According to CCSO's announcement, Bauer has more than 3 years of service to the office. In addition to daily responsibilities, Bauer has served as a member of the SWAT team. Before Bauer was selected as a canine handler, he invested time and effort into the canine program, according to the office's release. With the assistance of the Arizona Local Border Support funding, CCSO was able to acquire, train, and certify ACE in order to enhance its ability to combat narcotics-related criminal activity while strengthening public safety. And that wraps up that set of news briefs, and I'm going to move on next to letters to the editor. So let's see what your friends and neighbors have on their minds these days. First letter, healthy future of forests demands more, quicker action. The forest around Flagstaff is no longer just scenery. It is an early case study in the breakdown climate scientists warn will define this century. The demise of the iconic ponderosa pine across the Southwest and new research on forest die-off under hotter droughts show that what is happening outside this town's windows is part of a larger, more dangerous pattern. Since 2000, over 200 million ponderosa pines are estimated to have died, and several studies now suggest that more than 90% of southwestern ponderosa forests could disappear within a few decades, with many burned or drought-killed areas shifting to grass and shrub for centuries. In parts of the interior West, severely burned slopes are already failing to return to forest because seed sources are gone and conditions are too hot and dry for seedlings to survive. This crisis sits atop a century of fire suppression, leaving stands far denser than their historic, frequently burned condition and loaded with fuels. As a warming, drying climate collides with those fuels, fires burn hotter and larger, and old, patchy fire regimes are replaced by megafires that erase hillsides of mature trees. The result is not temporary damage, but long-term conversion away from forest. Yet proactive management still matters. Where forests have been thinned and treated with prescribed fire, ponderosa pine has been able to regenerate even under unfavorable conditions. There is a real, but narrowing, window in which large-scale, thoughtful use of fire and structural restoration can keep parts of this forest functioning. For Flagstaff, this is not abstract. As surrounding ponderosa belts thin and die, snowpack melts faster, floods grow more severe, wildfire risk to homes rises, and the culture and economic foundation of Flagstaff, built around its forest, erodes. A local newspaper can help readers face this moment or look away. Doing the former means stating plainly that the ponderosa forests are at risk, asking whether current thinning and fire programs match the scale of the problem, and covering growth, tourism, and water policy, knowing the forest shaping them may not survive in the future. Respectfully, signed respectfully, Michael Longnecker, Peoria. Next letter, candles continue to bring people together. Thanks to all our neighbors who helped in the 44th annual Christmas Luminarias. The candles lit the way once more for all to enjoy. This is a neighborhood event put on by neighbors for neighbors and is primarily a walking event. As Patty Briggs, the founder, stated, it seems like candles bring people together. There are many helpers involved in this free event. Alice and Robert Berger, Jason Dosh, Janet Freeman, Aaron and Caitlin Girard, and Jill and B.J. Hinkinius. Thanks also to the Flagstaff Baseball Club, Boy Scout Troop 7039, and the others who lit the luminarias for those who could not. Thanks to all of you. We would like to thank Robert Miller, Flagstaff Landscape Products, for cinders to fill the 7,000 bags. Thanks to Nat and Gene White and the Flagstaff Community Band for the beautiful music, and the Freer family who hosted the live nativity scene. Everyone enjoyed the two live camels this year. Thank you to Eric Souders. Thanks to Ron and Gretchen Volbrecht for leading the flag ukulele jammers. Thank you to Ben Schmidt and Mayorga's Welding for the cinders trailer. Thanks to Jane Jackson for leading the Jaywalkers. We enjoyed all that attended, especially those who walked through our neighborhood. See you next year. As always, Luminarias is the second Sunday before Christmas. And here's our next and final letter. A big, beautiful gift for the holidays, right? In this special time celebrating holidays, to what have we citizens of our state of Arizona, represented by Eli Crane, Andy Biggs, and Paul Gosar, brings a dispiriting sense, as their loyalty has long since been not to our Constitution or our general welfare, but to their own power, in my humble opinion. Over 400,000 fellow Arizonans will see increases in Affordable Care Act premiums, and about 2 million fellow Arizonans will see their Medicaid / CHIP support damaged or eliminated by their supporting of Trump's Big Beautiful Billionaires bill. Do Arizona voters think this is a gift for the holidays? Signed, Chuck Barnes, Flagstaff. And that wraps up our letters today. Not much time left today, but I can at least give you some teaser information from a couple of longer articles that I can't read in their entirety. The first is titled, Grants to Help County Battle Trafficking, Support Crime Victims. A trio of awards brought in more than $250,000 to the Coconino County Attorney's Office for work on victim services, victim restitution, and anti-human trafficking efforts. The Coconino County Board of Supervisors approved all three awards during Tuesday's meeting. And that was an excerpt from Grants to Help County Battle Trafficking, Support Crime Victims. And here's an excerpt from an article called Petition Against Page Data Center Proposal Disqualified. A citizen petition to block the sale of land for a proposed data center in Page was declared ineligible to be placed on the ballot last week in a blow to opponents of the project. The city of Page stated on Thursday, December 11th, that some of the petition signature sheets submitted for verification had a missing or incorrect serial number, and some did not include a copy of the city ordinance at issue. Because these requirements were not met, none of the submitted signatures were eligible for verification under Arizona law, the city statement read. The city does not have discretion to accept referendum petitions that do not meet these filing standards, nor can the city ignore or overlook them. This determination is the result of a statutory administrative process. And again, that's an excerpt from Petition Against Page Data Center Proposal Disqualified. And that's all the time we have today for news from the Arizona Daily Sun here in Flagstaff. And again, this was news from the Saturday, December 20th edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is your volunteer reader, Joe. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm going to be off for a few weeks, so I will see you when I get back. In the meantime, happy holidays to all of you and best of luck in the new year. Bye for now.